You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 4. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Carol Ellick about the history of archaeological education in the United States and what we can do moving forward.
Let's dig a little deeper. Okay, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, and today we're going to talk to Carol Ellick, and she wrote an article called A Cultural History of Archaeological Education, and it appears in the latest issue of the Society for American Archaeology's publication, Advances in Archaeological Practice, and that is, Volume 4 for 2016, pages 425 to 440, if you're interested in the reference, and that's the article that we read, and I saw it. It's a special issue all devoted towards public education and archaeology, and you know, for anybody not really understanding what that means, it doesn't mean teaching people like how to do archaeology. It means teaching people about archaeology, right? Teaching the public. It's not like a college curriculum. It's public displays and things like that to educate the public about not only the practice of archaeology but different archaeological sites and things like that. So, and kind of how we do that, and the whole issue is about that. But Carol wrote an article, like I said, The Cultural History of Archaeological Education, kind of getting into the background of this. So before we talk about that, Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And why don't you start just by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here this morning and to even more delighted that you've seen the article and you've seen the issue, because it truly is something that is important and has taken a very long time to get to the point where the field of archaeological education has found its place within the profession and now within professional peer-reviewed journals. Mm-hmm. I have been involved in public outreach and education within archaeology, anthropology for a really long time now. It's quite shocking when I look back on it. I started my career in cultural resource management, working as a field archaeologist and doing basically any kind of job that I could possibly do in order to stay employed in the field of archaeology. I found my niche for quite a while, splitting my time between doing field work and doing illustration. Hmm. And it worked really, really well. It kept me out of the unemployment line. But I also, during that time, realized that I really enjoyed sharing what we were learning with the public, because mm-hmm. ultimately in the field of cultural resource management, it's the tax dollar that pays for these projects to be done before the land is destroyed.
Right.
So if it's taxpayer dollars, the taxpayer really does deserve something back for the work that's being accomplished. People told me I was a natural teacher, and I went on to work on a project that was at an environmental camp that was for kids in grades 3 through 8 on archaeology and cultural history in the Southwest. And what I learned out of that experience was that even though I knew how to dig a square hole in the ground and knew how to identify a cultural object versus a natural one, I didn't know anything about the field of teaching. Mm-hmm. So that drove me back to school to get a master's degree in education with a specialization in curriculum and instruction. So it was kind of from that moment forward that my career took a left turn and completely mm-hmm. focused on public outreach and education. And I was lucky enough at that point to be working for a cultural resource management company called Statistical Research. And the owner of the company encouraged me to develop a public outreach program that could take the knowledge that was being gained on a project by project basis and get it out to the communities that were in the area where the projects were taking place. Mm-hmm. So I worked down there. It was statistical research down in Tucson, Arizona, and I worked for them doing this from the first contract that I won in 1994 until about 2003. And then I took what I was doing over to a brand new nonprofit called the SRI Foundation and developed a public program division within the nonprofit. So that was really where I got my start in doing public outreach. And I created everything from workshops for teachers and materials for classrooms to brochures, displays. I gave site tours, anything and everything that I could do to get the scientific information out to a particular public. And generally it was done under the, I would ask the project client what they were interested in, and then I would go and I would talk with the community, whether it be the teachers or the indigenous community, the area, or whomever, and try to create things that were project appropriate. So mm-hmm. it wasn't just a box that got checked off. It actually was a project that was specific to that project and that community.
Okay.
My life, that's kind of my beginning. I've done it. I've taken that base and done broader and broader things since then, creating my own business that focuses on public outreach and education. I created a program called Parallel Perspectives. That's a process for taking the traditional cultural knowledge and the anthropological and archaeological information and putting them side by side so people could build a broader understanding of the past. Mm-hmm. Anything and everything that takes what we do and makes it relevant to people.
Right.
So your article, would you mind just giving us a little summary of what it's about and the history of archaeological education in this country?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. The article, A Cultural History of Archaeological Education, really does try to summarize the evolution of archaeological education in the United States, which has been a focus for about 30 years. And it started officially at the grassroots level. And so what I tried to do in my article was look at the different fires that started in a state-by-state basis, as well as things that were happening at the national level in the professional archaeological organizations, in the federal agencies, and in the state agencies. And a lot of this started with legislation being enacted that actually said that the public was to be a beneficiary of the research that was being conducted. And the one law that is referred to the most is the National Historic Preservation Act, where it does say that the public is a beneficiary. And this legislation made it possible for people to think about what we were doing as a profession in a different way. And people took that to heart and tried to figure out how to create programs that shared this information and highlighted the importance of heritage to all people. One of the main reasons why people were doing this is because archaeological sites and historic areas are looted and vandalized at an alarming rate. And it was felt that if we could teach people about the importance of these places and to make them feel like this heritage was their own heritage and had importance to them, there was social value to it, that it would help reduce the vandalism that was being done to these places. So what I've tried to do in the article is go through in a sort of linear fashion and identify how this movement came about and how different groups of people have tried to take this initiative and really make a profession of it and to see how to make the most impact we can with the different publics that are out there.
So that's one of the things. I've got a lot of questions about the end of your article and how we can move forward on that. But,
right.
You know, framing this whole beginning portion of it, can you maybe define, because we're hoping to reach a wider audience than just archaeologists with this particular podcast, right? I mean, I interviewed you before for the CRM Archaeology podcast, which right. which is a very small audience related to like the rest of the country. But for this show, I'm hoping for it to be a public archaeology outreach. Could you first maybe define public archaeology, because I was actually just talking about this with my brother, and he's like, well, you know, archaeology is one of those sort of soft sciences that's maybe not taught much in schools. And I was like, well, I don't mean teaching people how to be archaeologists. Right. I mean, you know, you let me know what I mean. You know, what do you mean by public archaeology? And then maybe go through a quick history of some of the bigger, more well-known public archaeology initiatives that have taken place.
Well, public archaeology or archaeological education really is I'm going to back up a moment. The archaeology is two things. It's a process of scientific inquiry where you start with your question or your hypothesis and you collect data and you analyze the results and you write up your findings. Mm-hmm. Just like any science fair project that every single one of us has had to do in school for all those years, it follows that same process. But where that process becomes specific to the field of archaeology is our subject matter. Archaeologists study human beings, and we study these human beings by looking at the materials that they have left behind. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people think that archaeology has to do with peoples long ago in ancient Egypt. But in reality, archaeology is the study of people from any time in any place. The very first archaeology project that I ever worked on was a project called Le Projet du Garbage.
Fancy.
Which, I know, it sounds really fancy. It's actually the garbage project.
Nice.
And I know. And it was initiated in Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona. And we looked at social strata and social issues and looked at what people were eating and how people were living by examining the trash that was thrown away. And it wasn't stinky and nasty because in Tucson they actually collect it from households two times a week. And so what they did was they set up the research question to look at how different socio and economic groups survived, looking at one of the three basic things out of the food, water, and shelter that we need in order to survive. We looked at the food. What were people eating? What were people throwing away? And it was a fascinating project. And so archaeology is relevant in so many ways because we're trying to learn from how people have lived in the past, learn from the successes and mistakes, and then try to use that information to help people today and in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's a very relevant science. And as you said, it is a soft science, but it uses the scientific method and the focus is people. And what this profession of archaeological education does is it tries to find ways to make what we're learning relevant to people. Mm-hmm. And to share it with them. And so one of the main ways that people do this, people love creating things for schools and teachers, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting to get kids hooked on learning. But the issue is teachers, there's nowhere it says you teach archaeology.
Right.
But in every single state curriculum, it says that in about third grade and in about seventh grade, kids learn about the cultural history of that state. Mm-hmm. And it talks about it before European contact. So how do you know about before contact, before the explorers started writing journals about the people who were here? The way you use that is through archaeology. And so here's the perfect methodology for satisfying the state standards and getting kids good quality information about the cultures, the indigenous peoples of here or any other continent. Mm-hmm. So part of what we've tried to do is separate the scientific aspect from the content aspect and make it relevant to what people are interested in learning about.
Right. Okay. Well, in the last couple of minutes of this segment, can you just give us a brief summary of the bigger programs within the United States that have tried to achieve this, like some of the national programs maybe that have that you mentioned in your article that have tried to help out schools and give them materials and do different things?
Absolutely. I would like to highlight two programs. Mm-hmm. One program is actually for the general public. It's an absolutely amazing program that's been in place since about 1988. It's called Passport in Time.
Oh, yeah.
And Passport in Time was created by the Forest Service. And it's established so that the general public has the opportunity to go out and volunteer on archaeological and historical projects throughout the United States in the national forests. The projects can include actual archaeological excavation, historic restoration on historic buildings, archival research, photographic documentation, lab work, just mm-hmm. about anything that you can think of that falls under the topic of archaeology and historic preservation. There are projects ongoing throughout the United States that are open to the public. There's a website. The program is maintained through a clearinghouse for volunteer services. Mm. And the website is www.passportintime.com. And the programs run year round. Anyone who's interested in participating should know that the program is free of charge.
Okay.
That all you have to do is provide your own transportation, food, and lodging. Sometimes that might be a tent on the project, sometimes it's group meals. But it's an experience not to be missed. The other program that is more specifically aimed to school age children and teachers is a program that's called Project Archaeology. And this was a program that was started in the early 90s when the public outreach education effort really began to take off. And in the early 90s, it began in the state of Utah with the creation of a teacher's activity guide called The Intriguing Past, Investigating Archaeology. The program was so well received that the Bureau of Land Management decided to expand the program. They created a new center in Dolores, Colorado, called the Anasazi Heritage Center, and had a professional staff that was named the Imagination Team, mm-hmm. who, together with individual states, worked to create state cultural history guides for teachers that provided that cultural history from initial occupation up to the explorers, and from an archaeological perspective. And then they also started a new effort when the education system changed to requiring content education standards for each state, that reorganized the program to start creating modular units that focused on three things that are looked at in archaeology: shelter, migration, and subsistence. And okay. Those three themes now act as the base for the creation of units that can be used regionally by teachers in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So really, really amazing work that's available for teachers to get involved with and to use in their classroom.
Okay, well, we're going to go to break real quick, but we'll definitely get into some of this and how we think it's worked over the past few decades and then what we can do moving forward. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Would you like to get more involved with archaeology? Are you looking for volunteer or internship opportunities? Are you already working on community or personal archiving projects and could use some helpful hints? Check out the Ideas Portal, sponsored by Codify. Visit ideas.codify.com, a free and open community tool, and share your ideas, knowledge, and advice on select topics that will lead to vibrant opportunities and initiatives for all aspects of archaeology, from fieldwork to public service. All ideas are welcome, so visit ideas.codify.com today and make your voice heard. That's ideas.codify.com.
Okay, we're back. So in the first segment, Carol did a great job about telling us a little bit what this article is about and some big programs that are trying to help us out with public education in archaeology. But what I want to talk about, Carol, is you said in the first segment, and you know, April and I have both read the article, that you went through a sort of linear history of how this has worked, really from the, I guess, late 60s, early 70s on through to today. It seems to me, from reading this article, that a lot of the things that have been, you know, had risen and, you know, and subsided over the years have all kind of been versions of similar ideas. Not necessarily what was produced out of these things, but committees have been formed, articles have been written, goals have been written down, and all these things have happened. And it seems like almost a cycle of this just happening somewhat over and over again as a new group comes in or a new crowd of people, and there's new, you know, re-energized sort of momentum for getting this thing going, maybe from people like yourself that have been doing it for a long time, and you see a new crowd come in and sort of take over the mantle and say, all right, let's do this now. But what I want to know is, and you mentioned this in the article, that, you know, you've seen ways that the efforts have not gone unnoticed, that it has worked. But can you tell us a little bit about how some of the things that have actually worked and come out of these initiatives and these programs and committees over the last four decades and what they've done for public education? Because I've got some thoughts on that too, but I want to hear your thoughts on it first.
Okay, well, I'm going to preface this whole section with saying that what I've been most involved with since its inception was the Society for American Archaeology's Public Education Committee. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the efforts that came out of this movement in public education has been initiated through individuals on the Public Education Committee. When that committee first started back in 1990, it very quickly grew to the size of what could take over some small businesses, because within really short order, it had over 60 people on it, which is way beyond what most people would consider a regular committee. And we actually scared the board of directors of the Society for American Archaeology, I think, to death. But we did things. We were excited because each of those 60 individuals at that point had all been working alone in a vacuum. And we had no idea that there were other people out there who were as passionate about this as we were. So you bring all those people together and it's like an explosion. We had to learn how to work together, to collaborate, to come up with things in a group process, to ask questions about what will have the greatest impact and how to reach the most people in whatever public we were interested in reaching. And we did amazing things within the Society for American Archaeology for achieving that. But slowly over time, as things changed and public outreach and education became an integral part of the profession itself, the committee ended up being narrowed down into then just focusing as an advisory committee to the society. And those of us who wanted to continue doing public outreach had to find other ways to do it. And it took a while to rally that energy and bring us all back together. The focus, I think, has gone from doing things like sessions that were at the Society for American Archaeology, trying to host something that was for the community in which the event took place, because the SAAs take place annually in a different city across the United States. So each year we could host something for teachers, like a workshop, or provide a public session where we would have renowned archaeologists come and talk about what they were finding on the most recent excavations. And it worked okay, but the problem was we were asking people to leave their normal venues and come to ours. And it just wasn't the best way. So each time, each year, each group, not just within the Society for American Archaeology, but the Society for Historical Archaeology, tried to find better ways of bringing our professional selves out to the public. The weak point in all of this is that we were only working within our own professional archaeological organizations, and we had no professional organization for ourselves. We had nothing that provided the strength to what we were doing as public and outreach education specialists. And so I think that most of the most recent efforts that have taken place, starting about, I'd say, within the past 6 years, has been geared towards thinking about how to now take this established, accepted area of doing archaeology or doing anthropology or doing heritage, and bring that out not only to the profession, but to provide the professional support to all of those who actually do this. Mm-hmm. And this has kind of been something that has been in the back of people's minds, but people haven't been able to figure out how to do that, what actually was needed in order to do that. So in 2015, the Archaeological Institute of America had a workshop for archaeological education to bring people together to start the conversation again and to think about what we could do so that people who were entering this field didn't reinvent the wheel. It's like, here we've been doing this for over 30 years now. How can we benefit those who are coming in, and how can we take this profession forward from just this group of people doing the same thing over and over again to the next level? And it was an exciting moment because, again, we were brought together from working as individuals back to the power of the group to bring ideas and think about where we can go from here. So there were a couple of things that came out of it. One very exciting product was this journal that was specifically dedicated to public outreach and education that is the basis for this podcast. And the idea was to link together experienced professionals with emerging scholars in to give them the opportunity to start writing professionally within this field. And Eleanor King did just a phenomenal job of bringing this article about. And the Society for American Archaeology now has this journal, Advances in Archaeological Practice, which is a good forum for the practicing professionals to produce materials like this. The other kind of idea that is coming together out of this is that the article and the journal is so important, yet it's only available to the membership of the Society for American Archaeology. And what we're looking at trying to do next is figure out how to, after it's been a membership benefit for a period of time, to set it up so that there is open access, so that anybody and everybody can read, can have use of this to inspire their work as well.
Right. Well, you know, let me jump in on that real quick, because I see that as the biggest problem. I mean, you guys and everybody that's come up until this point, in the whole history of your article here, a lot of people have done a lot of great work. And I feel like one of the biggest ways that I know that's true is that I didn't even consider not involving public archaeology when I came up through when I went to my undergrad, you know. And I don't remember public archaeology even being like a thing, but I don't remember it not being, you know what I mean? It's like, it was so inherent in like,
right,
hey, let's tell people about this, that I don't remember even learning it. I just know it. You know what I mean? So
that
I think is the biggest legacy from all that. But moving forward, I'm just, like this article, this whole journal, you know, the SA Advances is great, this special issue, but who's going to see that besides all of us archaeologists that are part of the SAAs that actually decide to actually open those emails and read this this journal, quite frankly? I feel like we've been doing it. What I'm getting at is I feel like we've been doing a really good job at educating archaeologists, and now it's part of the conversation, it's part of the thing, and that we don't really need to keep doing that too much. I feel like we're preaching to the choir, and that we need more programs that focus outward rather than inward. What do you think about that? I mean, it seems like a lot of this stuff that you mentioned here in the article, you know, every decade something new would come along or re-energize something old, but it's just more of the same. You know what I mean? And it's just more of the continuing on. So how do you respond to that?
Well, that's a really good point. I think that what we've done is an amazing job of making public outreach known as a part of what we do as professionals. And we've raised a generation now who are coming out of school thinking that this is part of what they do. What we haven't done a good job of is setting what the standard is. where there are no guidelines of what's appropriate. Like I was talking about earlier about how I would look at the community and I would look at where the project was and who the client was and how much money was involved. And I would come up with a product that was appropriate to that project. There are no guidelines about how to do this.
That's
people
true.
Just say, I'm going to build a sandbox did for the kids. And every time I hear something like that, I just groan because what does that teach them other than it's really fun to go in the backyard and dig up? And there's history in all of our backyards.
It teaches them to be pot hunters.
it can be very frightening. And so what we need now is to professionalize what we do. And this circles back around to another one of the ideas that has been simmering in the back of my head for years, which is that we need a professional organization that supports those who do public outreach and education, those who want to enter the field of public outreach and education, and those who consume the information, like the teachers, the interpreters, the museum exhibit designers. And so we need one organization that will support all of us and then continue to provide advice and assistance to the archaeological and anthropological organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the process right now of working with a wonderful board of people to create this new organization, and it's called the Heritage Education Network. And it's going to exist primarily online, and it will offer a comprehensive library of resources that can be referenced by public outreach and education professionals, as well as resources for the teachers, for the interpreters, mm-hmm. for the exhibit designers. It'll be one place that ties us all together so that we're not all just working within our individual committees.
Right.
And the organization has two pages of website set up. We just won a wonderful grant that is going to assist us in building the website itself over the next year or so. But the organization is called the Heritage Education Network, and the website is theheritageeducationnetwork.org.
Okay.
So This is a way to stop just running around in the same circle and take it from where we are now and move it forward.
So I'm really excited about that because I do a lot of education and programming and I work with museums. And one of the things that as Chris and I were developing this episode, we realized is that while we both readily accept that public archaeology and reaching out and engaging other audiences is central to what we do, a lot of us don't receive any training in mm-hmm. how to actually do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're all kind of stumbling around blind or a lot of people are stumbling around blind. And there's also, I think, a lot of times a disjunct between what archaeologists think is important and what we need to teach and what educators and the public think is interesting and
yes.
they want to learn. So I kind of wanted your thoughts on how we both start training archaeologists so that we actually know how, you know, you went and got a master's in education. How do we teach ourselves or start training new generations to put together meaningful programs? So it's not just a new dig in the backyard, but then maybe in the next segment, kind of also consider how do we then reach into these communities like you've been doing and really create programming that they want?
Right. Well, that's a fabulous question. And that is something that a lot of us have been looking at and considering what are the professional guidelines that we need to take into consideration for someone who wants to go into museum specialty. There are museology programs that are available for students at particular universities, but when someone wants to go into public outreach, that's usually where they get spooned. You know, they get placed because when people think of reaching the public, you think of, oh, there's a museum. And so, yeah, one, and it's all about informal education. You know, people learn about archaeology from the television, from visiting museums, from magazines like National Geographic. All of these are the ways that people find out about archaeology and the cultures that we study. And so what we need to do is, how do we become better at what we do so that we can be more effective in reaching audiences where they're enjoying the information?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've got a number of questions on that. So before we get too far into this, let's take our final break, and then we'll come back and really talk about, Carol, your last comment there, and then some other stuff that we can do moving forward. All right, back in 1 minute.
This is Christopher Sims, host of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. It's a show geared for early career archaeologists where I bring interviews and casual panel discussions about the challenges and opportunities that many archaeologists encounter starting off. So, if you're still in school, thinking about going back, just getting started, or want to take the next step, you'll find what you need to go dig a hole. Tune in every other week on the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Okay, we're back. And so, Carol, I want to ask you a couple things. One, we were talking about museums right at the end there. And one thing that made me really think about museums and how ineffective they are about teaching about archaeology, but really good about teaching people about artifacts and maybe even the history of artifacts and sites and things like that. I was in Naples, Italy a couple months ago, and we went to the archaeology museum there, which everybody says it's just this fantastic museum, and sure, it's huge. They have a lot of really amazing sculptures and things, a lot of stuff from Pompeii, but it really is just one more thing that shows people, hey, look at these cool artifacts that you can't have, you can't touch, so that means if you find one out in the quote-unquote wild, you better pick it up and put it in your pocket, because otherwise an archaeologist is going to lock this away so you'll never get to touch it again. And I feel like living in Nevada where I do, that's what people think. People think archaeologists just hoard all this stuff for themselves because the BLM has warehouses of artifacts and reports that nobody can see. So when they're out hunting or they're out, you know, hiking or doing whatever, and they see a quote unquote arrowhead, and they just pick it up because they're like, oh, I'm never going to see anything like this again. I'm going to just put this in my pocket. So first off,
yeah,
how do you think we can make museums better, because that is one way a lot of people see archaeology, if not for the first time, the only time besides Indiana Jones. And then following up to that, how can we, as like I'm a CRM archaeologist, I own a small CRM firm, how can we, without starting a foundation like SRI did, because nobody can really do that, how can we put together like kits? Like I've done a number of projects with my company, and I should just have all our projects are the same, right? We have, you know, this type of project, and this type of project. I should be able to go to a resource and say, if you have this type of project, this has been shown. It's an industry standard in how to present this to the public in these formats. Yeah. Here's your you know, public PubArc hobby kit. Go to town. Why doesn't something like that exist? And I hope the Heritage Education Network puts it together. So lots of questions there, but tackle them any way you want.
All right, a couple of things. First, let's get into the museum's question.
Right.
When museums were first established, they were established to collect objects with the idea that in the United States, these cultures, these native peoples were going to be disappearing. So you had to get it before it's all gone. And so the basis for a lot of the museums in the United States is just that. And globally, the curators would go out and they would, by any way they could, get things to put in the museum to protect and preserve. And it's built up of the objects taken out of the context of the cultures. And I think that nowadays, that has been changing. But because the institutions are so large and have had one particular way of dealing with things for so long, it's like shifting a glacier. Right. And even though now the objective is not about get it before it's gone, it's more about interpreting culture and working with community and being responsible to people and telling the story. Each time you build an exhibit, it takes an extraordinary amount of money to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a really slow progression, a generation of change in order to really see that take effect in museums. And they are happening. There are some absolutely phenomenal exhibits that are done collaboratively between museum peoples and the communities that are being represented in the exhibits. So I think that things are changing, but the museums have their part education, their part display, and their part curate it and protect it. So there's a whole lot of things about museum that the general public doesn't see, and they're just phenomenal institutions. Right. As to your question regarding how can you or other cultural resource managers or companies do public outreach that isn't just the same thing over and over, or how do you tailor a product to the project, and how can you find out how that's done? I actually have a workshop that I teach that is all about doing just that, how to look at a project, a budget, a community, and to develop a product that is appropriate to it. So it can be looked at in a very formulaic sort of way. Mm-hmm. And I offer the workshop on a request basis. It's it's called The Public Benefits of Archaeology. Nice. I think it's been a long time since I've done it, so I'm kind of rusty on the name, but it's about how to do this within a CRM framework. And right. I'd be happy to share more information about that with you or anyone else who's interested.
Okay. Well, yeah, that sounds really good. Cause I feel like, you've already talked about, and you mentioned in your article as well, programs that have put together materials for teachers. And I work in I also am a member of the Civil Air Patrol, and we have an aerospace education thing that we can hand teachers. And it's basically just a kit that says, here, teach this way with these materials, right?
Yeah.
I feel like we should just do the same thing for CRM archaeologists. You know, I mean, a workshop is a good place to start, but really we're lazy. People want a lot of the work done for them. They want to say, here, you have this thing here, fill in the blanks, and you've done public archaeology. You know what I mean? And I know it's not that simple, and every project is different depending on the community you're working with, but sometimes it is that simple, especially if your early steps are, hey, put together a web page or something like that that follows these guidelines or something, you know, something as simple as that, people might not even think about it. So maybe something to consider. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's part, you know, that's a terrific idea, and it's something that I think that can happen within this new organization, the Heritage Education Network. And I think that something that should be kept in mind is that archaeological education, public outreach, heritage education, whatever you want to call it, it is a profession, and the individuals who have taken this on as their career have a knowledge base that your average archaeologist does not have. And just like you would not hire a person who specializes in analyzing animal bones found on an archaeological site and have them analyze the ceramic fragments, because that's not their area of expertise. Every archaeologist should not be just simply looked at as having the ability to develop public outreach products. It's a profession. And so I think that the Heritage Education Network will lay out what should be looked for if you are going to hire someone to do a specific public outreach component. There will be guidelines for doing things and the ethics of doing things at an appropriate way within appropriate community. And I think that it would be great if we could have a system set up so that if someone wanted to do public outreach, they could come to the Heritage Education Network, look for an individual with the talents to work with them on creating the benefits that they would like to out of their projects.
I think this helps with something that I think both museums right now and archaeology are struggling with, which is not just showing objects or talking about this is what we do, this is what stratigraphy is, but saying this is a question we were asking. Here's how we used archaeology to answer this question. This is why archaeology is valuable. And I think that's the step people are pushing towards now, because we've realized that it's easy to tell people, hey, this is what an archaeologist does, and it sounds cool and exciting, but it still doesn't tell people why archaeology is valuable and why it needs to be invested in and protected.
Right. And the education isn't just the kids. I mean, that's fabulous, and I love it, and it's so much fun to work with kindergartners. But we need to educate others. We need to educate the politicians, the people who make the laws and protect and preserve the heritage for everyone, or have the potential of disabling the whole system that is currently in place. We need to be the ones who learn how to communicate what we do and how we do it and why to every type of audience, no matter if it's the senior center or the kindergartner or the politician, the legislator from your community. So it's part of our role, and it's about educating, and that it's not about picking up the arrowhead and looking at it and putting it back in its place so that you don't remove it from context, because we know that context is the key to it all. But that is what we need to let people know. It's okay to touch it, but put it back. And the reason why it's still there for you to look at after 500 or 1,000 years is because someone else looked at it and put it back.
Well, that's
so, yes.
I think if I could teach everyone on the planet, or at least, hey, even in Nevada, as far as I'm concerned, if I could teach everybody two pieces of information, it would be, one, why you're right, why they should do exactly that, what context is and why that's important, and also why there is no real ownership of things. People see public land and they say, well, I can pick this up. This is public land. And, and I can pick this up and take it and do whatever I wanted with it. And even Native Americans, you know, I've worked with Native American monitors that say, well, this is my ancestor's stuff, so I can actually pick it up and take it away. And it's like, well, you still need to understand the context where that's in if you actually want to know something about, you know, what that artifact is doing there, you know, if you want to know something about why that's there. So teaching people about context and about ownership, quite frankly, you know, I think those are two really important things. In the last few minutes here, I want to talk about what I think personally that we can really do to help this, because Carol, I think you were nailing it right on the head at the end there, is we don't need to just teach children. We need to teach, parents, politicians, everybody about why these things are important. I mean, we look at something like, I don't know, drunk driving or something like that, or texting while driving. How about that? We all kind of do it. We all kind of do it sometimes a little bit, but we all know it's wrong. and I don't think people know that picking up arrowheads and artifacts is wrong. You know, I've talked to plenty of people that they just don't get why it's wrong. You know what I mean? And that's the fundamental failure of that whole thing. And to me personally, and this wasn't mentioned in your article, which is another reason I wanted to talk to you, One of the biggest ways we can really do that moving forward, to me, is through the media that people use. And that's TV, movies, podcasts are becoming a huge thing. The Archaeology Podcast Network, we have, as of this month, over 35,000 monthly subscribers from around the world. I mean, that's
wow.
That's huge. You know, I've almost stopped giving papers at the SAAs because I feel like the 15 people in that room that I'm actually giving my paper to already know what I'm going to say. Right. And I'm just like, what am I doing here? But I can give a podcast and 10,000 people will hear it. So I feel like we need to focus on the mediums of work. I mean, you know what got me into archaeology? Indiana Jones. I'm a child of the 80s, right? So I was born in 75 and Indiana Jones got me interested in archaeology because I was like 10 when the first one came out. So we need more stuff like that. As bad as he is, you know, he's a pot hunter with a gun. We all know that, but he got me at least thinking about archaeology as a thing, right? So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think, is there anything, I mean, the SAA, the SHA, they always put out these letters, these open letters to shows like Diggers on National Geographic Channel and other stuff like that saying, oh, that's bad, you're teaching it wrong. But they're not putting out anything saying, maybe this is how you should do it, as being proactive, not just responding to negative shows on TV, but actually being proactive and maybe even producing their own shows or sponsoring the production of shows. What do you think about that?
Okay, you just put out a whole bunch of questions.
Sorry. You've got 5 seconds. Go.
It's okay. It's really exciting. I think there's a couple things. Number one, Indiana Jones is fabulous. I love it. And anybody from any profession will complain. I grew up listening to my father harumph whenever he saw a medical show on TV, because that's not how it's done, he would scream. That patient would be dead, he would scream.
Right.
Well, Indiana Jones is fabulous. And part of what you need to do with that is put it into context.
Yeah.
We look at him as a looter and a vandal with a gun, but he also represents how museums built their collections in the beginning. Not quite as dramatic as, Indiana Jones, but it's a romanticized version of what we do. I love programs like that. I love Laura Croft Tomb Raider. I mean, they romanticize, they make it exciting, but what we should be doing is building education materials based on those things that bring it down into the realities of what we can contribute. And I think that the idea of the SAA doing a television show is a great idea, but number one, there's no money. Number two, who's got the ability to actually do that? So what we do, I think, is we continue to work with these producers of the media, whether they're in museums or radio or podcasts or the movie theaters. We, as part of our ethical responsibility, work with these individuals to give them good information and to produce good shows that get across the excitement of archaeology, like Time Team America,
right,
which is built on the British Time Team series that was around for about 15 years. Time Team America is a fabulous program. It was produced out of Oregon Public Broadcasting. They did 5 shows in the first season. They did 4 shows in a season that was produced another year later. But public broadcasting looked at the ratings and decided that they could not contribute the money to keep the show going on a continual basis. And so how do we keep the good things that do portray the accurate messages, that have fantastic programs based on real archaeological sites with archaeologists doing the work? How do we get those out there in the forefront more? And how do we get them funded? I think that those are great questions. And the Society for American Archaeology, the Society for Historical Archaeology, they work hard to try to let people know what's appropriate and what's inappropriate and offer people to help them. But you can't do what American Diggers You can't force them into doing anything except for to perhaps try to influence them by giving them appropriate information and let them know the damage that's done when they get across some of their concepts that it's okay to go out with a shovel and dig on these sites and take it home.
Right.
So before we leave you for the day, we have one last question. First, at the end of the show, we always have a list of, you know, show notes and. But for our listeners, both professional and non-professional, if they're interested in learning more or just getting involved in different types of archaeology education and outreach, mm-hmm. are there ways that you would really suggest or places that they could look to find, you know, what's going on locally for them?
Oh, absolutely. Just about every state has a professional archaeological organization or a state archaeological association, and every single state has a state historic preservation office that offers different services and information to people on a state basis. Almost every state in the United States now participates in an archaeology day, week, or month mm-hmm. set of events that is open to the public. Absolutely phenomenal presentations about what is going on in their communities. Archaeological Institute of America has started an international archaeology day, and that's every October when that comes up. So there are things that people can do in addition to the national programs like Passport in Time, where people can get involved and go out. I recommend, you know, going to your museum, walking in and saying you have an interest in anthropology or archaeology or heritage, and volunteering. Lord knows all those museums can use some help because they're all understaffed and underfunded. It's just a matter of thinking and taking the time to look at what's around you and jump in.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. That was perfect. It's an absolute pleasure having you with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. As you could tell, I get kind of excited about this topic.
Nice.
You know, it's in Chris and I's wheelhouse, too, to get easily excited about this.
That's right. I feel like we could have gone easily another hour on this, just going back and forth on it. But unfortunately, like April said, we're out of time. So if you have the ability, go check out Carol's article. Otherwise, go check out a lot of the things we talked about today. Everything we talked about today is on the show notes for this page. So go check that out as well. It's at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/TAS/4. So you just look for the Archaeology Show, episode 4. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Carol. And thanks, April, for joining us today. And we will see you guys next time.
Thank you to both you, Chris, and to April.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.